Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello?
Mama.
Welcome back to Pick a Flick. I'm your host this evening, Emma Platt, and joining me is Clint Thiel. Did I say that right?
Yes, you did.
I hyped myself up so much to not say it wrong, and then my brain went, no. So tonight, we are going to be talking The Babadook and The Borderlands. It's a bit of a horror special. The Babadook is a 2014 Australian-Canadian psychological horror film, which was written and directed by Jennifer Kent in her directorial debut. It stars a grieving mother and her son who are tormented by an evil entity. It had a very short limited release in Australia, which didn't receive a lot of commercial success. However, after it was shown at the Sundance Film Festival and received critical acclaim, it was given a wider release.
Where'd you get this?
On the shelf.
If it's in a word or it's in a look, you can't get rid of the Babadook. A rumbling sound, then three sharp knocks. That's when you'll know he's around. You'll see him if you look.
Babadook, duck, duck.
This is what he wears on top. He's funny, don't you think? See him in your room at night.
Mum, does it hurt the boy? Mum? Does it live under the bed? Mom? Mummy! Mummy!
Before The Babadook was released, a lot of magazines in the UK, like Empire and Total Film, were really hyping it up to be one of the scariest horror films of, like, the last 10 years or so. But after I saw it, I kind of got the feeling that it was marketed wrong, because while it's scary, it's not the typical type of scary that's popular in horror films these days. It is a lot more psychological. There's a lot more layers to it, I think. I think what interested me about The Babadook is that there are several ways you could possibly read the film. You could, of course, read it as the fact that the Babadook is a real entity tormenting this family. You could read it as it's a manifestation of the mother's grief and depression, or that the whole thing is just made up. There's not many jump out your skin moments. It's a much more slow burner in my eyes. Would you agree with that, Clint?
Oh, absolutely. But what I really liked with this one was that the slow burn was consistent. You know, I felt like it was pretty consistently building towards something.
Yeah, it was quite, it was really tense because it didn't let up. There was no kind of, okay, this is okay, we're going to have a little break for this scene or whatever. It was constantly even if it was almost like there in the background, because of especially with Amelia's kind of torment and her grief and the friction she had with, like, you know, her friends and the people she worked with and her family, there was always that going on, you know, even if the Babadook threat wasn't present at the time, there was that kind of tension, especially with his son Sam, kind of wondering what is he going to do next. You know, he's taking weapons into school, he's pushing kids out treehouses. There was always something going on to just kind of keep that nervousness.
Yeah, and then didn't know if he was in a fog after he was put on the tranquilizers after that, I guess, essentially a seizure.
Yeah. When it first started and I was watching it, it was kind of like, I hate this kid. This kid is typical annoying horror film father. But obviously, you straight away, given the backstory of this child's lost his father before he ever knew him, and you kind of get the sense that Sam is really haunted by this ever-presence of the ghost of his father, because his mother won't let him celebrate his birthday and all that kind of thing. It's you know, this absent father is this huge figure in this film, especially because of the way Amelia has handled her grief. She's kind of stuck in this time warp, in this singular moment, the moment of the accident. It seems like she's never moved past that, and she hasn't really bonded with her son. And that's what I found really interesting about this. It wasn't about the shocks and the scares and the jumps necessarily, because there was a lot more behind it and a lot more to it. And I think while a lot of films you could always say, oh, that was just a dream, or that was just made up, or the character's crazy, I think this kind of handled that possibility in a more realistic sense.
Yeah, I can see that.
I think the book showing up as well, it kind of laid out what was going to happen. You know, Amelia was going to kill the dog, and then she was going to kill Sam, and then she was going to kill herself. So we had these kind of moments that you knew the film was going to hit. And I think what I found really interesting was that the presence of this figure, this entity, pushed her to understand what was really important to her. I know she'd already lost her husband, and she'd been so depressed about it for so long, but now it was, you could almost read it as losing her husband could cause her to lose her son, not just particularly because she wasn't a very involved mother or whatever, but she was going to be the reason that she lost her son, whether, you know, through somebody else getting involved, like there was social services involved with Sam at school, or whether she was actually going to kill him. And she needed to recognize herself as a threat in one way or another to stand up to this beast or whatever it was and take back that power.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, there were even more subtle hints, you know, that really played into that as well. Like when, I guess you could call them the social workers, when they stop by to talk to, you know, when they stop by to talk to Amelia about, you know, Sam not being in school, you know, and he had his little, you know, side comments like, you know, I'm really tired from the drugs mommy gave me and, you know, things like that, just, you know, that are throwing up these big glaring red flags to, you know, anybody else around. And, you know, Amelia's just like, you have no idea, you know?
Yeah, and I think the film did a really good job of, like, isolating Amelia, not just through her own, because to me, the film is really about her grief and her depression, and not so, there's an ambiguity about it, but she is so isolated because her own sister is kind of like, you should move on, you should forget about him, it was 6 years ago, but she's so isolated by this event in her past and her kind of weird son that there's no one for her to reach out to when these bad things try and happen. And even when she goes to the police, in typical horror movie fashion, they're just kind of like, nah, no, go home, love, go home. So she's really isolated, and you get this really, I felt sorry for her, but at times I was also really frustrated by her, by the way she's like snapping at the child and almost like what happens could be, this is going to sound really harsh, but it's almost her own making by creating this environment for her and her son and living in this really dark, horrible, oppressive environment. She invites in this badness, this evil that then threatens her and her child.
Yeah, and, you know, she was just, I mean, at that point, you know, she's essentially powerless and worn down, and You know, because you gotta keep in mind, too, one of the recurring themes throughout the movie was her sleep deprivation. You know, that she hasn't, for a long time, you know, been able to get one night of consistent sleep. You know, and, you know, if you think about the effects of the sleep deprivation, I mean, I know I'm, you know, pretty grumpy and quick to snap if I don't get enough sleep at night, you know,
yeah.
You know, and that's just after one night. But, you know, when you magnify that, you know, to the extent that she had it on top of, you know, dealing with Sam and not knowing how to deal with him, you know, she's just completely at her wit's end. And, you know, I mean, I believed her when she was, you know, telling him, you know, well, like after that scene where, you know, he's trying to tell her, you know, mommy, I'm hungry, you know, can you make me something to eat? You know, and she's like, just turns around and she's like, well, you can go and eat shit, you know? But when she goes into the room and she's like, you know, mommy didn't know what she was saying and, you know, I'm so sorry, that wasn't me. I mean, I believe that.
Yeah, I mean, it does. That kind of reminded me of the very early days of my son not sleeping through, and that kind of fog that kind of just descends over you. You are just like, you are such a zombie. You're doing everything. Oh, baby needs to be fed. Baby needs a nappy change. Baby's asleep. When I have to clean up. So I think everyone's had those moments, but the film did such a good job of, like, I mean, the actor who plays Sam as well, his reaction to it. Like I said, there were times when I was like, this kid is so annoying. Like, he's a little brat. But then when he was like, all he wanted was for his mum to love him. And you kind of get this sense all the way through that she's not able to love him. She's not able to mother him because that's what happened in the past. And I kind of like the ending as well. I really like that because it wasn't so much like she's defeated the evil and it's gone. It's more like she had controlled it. And she had kind of put it in a safe place.
Yeah, yeah. She wasn't necessarily able to destroy it, you know, but she was able to subdue it and, you know, being able to keep it at bay. But that was kind of something that there was something unsaid in that moment, you know, between, you know, when she basically takes back her house. And, you know, when he gets locked and confined to the basement, you know, it's like, what kind of agreement did, you know, they have in that minute in between that all of a sudden, you know, this thing's able to live in the basement? You know, I was like, okay, what did we not see? But I liked how they did it too, though, because, you know, especially toward the end when you get, you know, start seeing, you know, that a lot of the physical manifestation of it is, you know, reminiscent of the father.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, it was very telling that he's confined to the basement where all the father's things are kept as well. Although that was very, like, you know, not, I don't want to say symbolic, but I thought it was a nice little kind of tying in to, and it, I think it also gives credence to the whole, well, it's just a manifestation of her grief. But then that's almost too easy to say that none of this happened and she was just going off a rocker because she hasn't slept and the kids driving her mad and all that kind of thing. But I think if you almost look at it like the Babadook is a real thing, and like I said, by creating this environment, she is allowed it in and it's fed off the almost energy of the father. Then to keep it in the basement with the father's things, it's almost like I'm stepping away from that. These things still exist. I still have these memories. I have his physical things, but they are in the basement. They are in the basement of my mind, almost, to put it a really cliche, horrible way.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know if you felt this way, but after watching it a second time, because, you know, the first time I'd seen it was, you know, quite a while back, but I was just rewatching it again last night, and there's something still anticlimactic at the end, you know, because, you know, she may have been able to essentially process her grief and move on in, you know, in that sense, but Sam's still really no closer to knowing his, you know, to really knowing the memory of his father, and he's still kept out of the basement and, you know, still kept out of the memories. And
yeah, no, I agree. It's I think she had built up a lot of Sam's life to be really rooted in this, the day you were born, your dad died. And she's really made a lot of Sam's, who Sam is at such a young age, about the absence of his father and why his father isn't there and all this. And, you know, even maybe some sort of blame on her part, you know, if I hadn't had you, mm-hmm. we wouldn't have got an accident. But she has set this child up to be defined by this moment. And you kind of, I mean, I know she has the birthday party for him on his actual birthday at the end, but like you said, there's so much has been said to Sam and done to Sam about his dad, and yet, like, she's just like, well, it's in the basement now. The Babadook's in the basement now, your dad's in the basement now. And that's all well and good for her, but this is her child. So it's kind of almost like you could, she's almost neglecting her child in that way by not telling him about his dad when he was a person instead of this memory. But I really, really enjoyed this film. I mean, it's so much different from a lot of the cheap shockers we get nowadays, you know, with just loads of gore and, you know, mutant zombie cannibals from nuclear waste and all that kind of thing. You know, it's, there was actually some thought and some depth behind it, and I really, really liked that. I also like the aesthetic of it, almost gothic, but not too gothic, not like Guillermo del Toro gothic, but
yeah.
And I really did like it, and I thought the actors were all really fantastic in it, because they made me go to a I hate you, I like you, I want you to win, I hope you die kind of, you know, roller coaster. They weren't two dimensional, yeah. So I really enjoyed this. And I know it was based on a short film called Monster, and apparently the director said they made Babadook pop-up books to give out to the studios when they were shipping the script around. I don't know if that's true, but that is not a book I would want in my house, whether it's real or not, because that shit is freaky.
Yeah, I heard it was part of, I heard about the book thing too, but heard it was part of some kind of limited crowdfunding campaign or something, and because a lot of the money that crowdfunding campaign raised, from what I read, went toward the went toward like the art direction and, you know, things like that. It went toward all of the artistic elements of the movie. But I honestly, I mean, you know, unlike you, I'd love to get my hands on a copy of that book.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those. Books are, they're really popular in horror for bringing about the bad crap, aren't they? I mean, you got mm-hmm. the Necronomicon from, like, The Evil Dead, and even the, like, Cabin in the Woods and things like that. It's always a bad yeah. book, a bad old dusty book, you know? I'm sure soon we'll see, like, a haunted e-reader or something, like a Kindle gone bad or something like that. It's the next logical step for crappy horror films, but...
Yeah, well, you had that, What was the name of it? Unfriended?
Oh, yeah.
Or whatever, where it was like the ghost was like inside of the Skype call.
Yeah. It's just, I mean, I love horror films, but I always say they usually make the money back because people constantly want to go see them. So it's nice to see one with a bit of thought behind it, and it seems like a little bit more effort. It's not just shaky cam, go, you know, Ouija board and all that kind of thing. It was nice, and it created its own mythology, which I really liked. You know, this whole Mr. Babadook thing, and even the way he looked, he reminded me a lot of I don't know if you've seen this, it was a BBC series, The League of Gentlemen. There's a character in it called Papa Lazaro, and he was scary as hell, and he reminds me a lot like that, with the top hat and things like that. But he had a very memorable aesthetic, which is important for a, you know, a horror icon almost.
Oh yeah, because the aesthetic of the, you know, of the antagonist is, it can, you know, it can totally make the movie, you know, totally make a movie, you know, especially once you like nail down that definitive look, like Freddy Krueger from Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, it's has a very definitive look, and, you know, you try to alter that, and it just wouldn't, you know, it just wouldn't work, you know, which, you know, since they did try to remake that movie in 2010 and it just didn't work. You know, well, for many reasons, but one, you just looked at, you know, Jackie Earle Haley at that point, who played Freddy Krueger, and you're just like, he's not Freddy.
No.
You know, like, he does not look like Freddy Krueger. You know, so yeah, no, you're right. I mean, a totally important element to these movies is nailing down that look.
Yeah, and I think a lot of horror films nowadays don't put a lot of emphasis on the villain or their antagonist or the evil. It's just, like I say, it's a lot of kind of just ghosts from a Ouija board or that kind of thing. There's no thought behind it. But like you said, Freddy Krueger, you don't even have to... I mean, you could just do the red and green jumper, the striped jumper, and people will go, Freddy Krueger. You don't necessarily even need the hat or the glove. You just need that one thing. But, you know, Michael Myers, you know, Jason Voorhees, all are... You've got that instant
recognition?
That's what I meant. I nearly said recognizability. That's where that came from. But yeah, and I think this had that as well, which was really good. It wasn't just... And you didn't... You only got, like, glimpses of the Babadook. They didn't overshow it. They didn't, like, push it, like, oh, look, it's the Babadook. Look at it, look at it, look at it. They really used it effectively. And I think that also helped the creepy element.
Oh, yeah. You know, we were kind of touching on this a little bit ago, but with all of the, you know, aesthetic of the movie and not having to rely on a lot of the gore and, you know, the jump scares and things like that, one of the things that I loved, you know, this little piece of trivia that I had read, and then when I watched the movie again, I was like, yeah, they did do that. It's like, minus the dog, all people that were alive at the beginning of the movie were still alive at the end. So, like, no people actually died in this movie.
God, I completely forgot that as well. Like, that's the thing of horror film. Didn't kill anyone off and was still scary and tense. That's bloody unheard of these days. That's quite fascinating.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
I really did enjoy it, and I don't know many people who I've spoken to who've seen it who didn't like it. I'm not going to say it's like a special little film, because I nearly did for some goddamn reason, but it's definitely the type of horror film I'd like to see more of in the future instead of...
Absolutely.
You know, the endless... You know, Paranormal Activity sequels and Insidious and that kind of thing, because after a while, it's just not effective anymore, because you get to know the way, you know, get to know the film's formula and the way the film works. And if they change that formula with every sequel, then people will just get pissed off, because people like to know what's going on. You know, the killer's going to get defeated at the end and all that kind of thing. But I really did enjoy it, and hopefully we will see more of this type of film in the future. So the next film for tonight, the next picked flick, is 2013's The Borderlands. It is a British found footage horror film, and the feature film directorial debut of Elliot Goldner, who also wrote the movie script. It is about a priest, a deacon, a Scottish priest and a paranormal investigator, known for his scepticism, who helps debunk claims of paranormal events. He's hired by the Vatican to investigate a secluded church in the English countryside that is rumoured to be the site of a miracle. He is joined in his investigation by technology expert Gray and the fellow minister, Mark.
This glorious miracle in your house of worship.
Yeah, what's this fellow here?
Yeah.
He looks like an agreeable local bumpkin type.
Hi, can you tell us where the church is around here?
Yeah, like, you know, it's a big pointy building with a spire on top.
Please be quiet.
To examine the altar. And here's the crucifix. Must cross-check crucifix against video footage.
Deacon, what we saw up there was not normal. Was not normal.
As I was walking down by the Royal Arsenal, the
Show us if we can.
slow to start. I was like, for 20 minutes, I was like, this is awful. This is, what the hell is going on? But after those 20 minutes, it was like a completely different film. It was not what I was expecting at all.
I gotta say, it was better than I was expecting. But yeah, it took a while to really pick up and find its, you know, and find its foothold in its setting. Because, like, even when I messaged you guys earlier, I was like, man, this movie is so slow.
Yeah. It really was.
But yeah, that, you know, that it was like maybe 5-10 minutes after I said that, I'm like, you know, it starts picking up. I'm like, ooh, this is intriguing.
Yeah. You have certain expectations from it because it's fan footage and it's, ooh, a haunted church and that kind of thing. But it does not go down the route that you think it's going to go down. And, I mean, when the sheep was on fire, I was just like, what the hell? I was like, what the hell is that noise? And then I was just like, oh my, like completely horrified by the fact that there was a bleeding sheep on fire. I think that freaked me out more than anything else in the film.
Yeah, I felt so bad for that sheep.
Yeah. It's a really hard film to describe because you have all these, like, thought it was going to be like the, I think it was called, what was it called? The Rite with Anthony Hopkins a couple of years ago. And then you've got like the, oh, what the hell? There's another film and I completely forgot the name. I think it's like an American.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
And haunting or something like that, where it's all about like priests and exorcisms and all this kind of thing, and it's nothing like any of those films. And I like the fact there was like the Vatican element in it. Like, it wasn't just like, no, the church says none of these things exist. It was kind of like, okay, well, this is our official stance on it, but maybe check this out just in case something is going on. And when you see the first video and he's like, this is what happened, it's such like, you know, there's noises and then the candle moves and then he thinks it's God, and you're like, that's such a, you know, that's not necessarily a big deal. But then it just keeps getting weirder and weirder. And like, when he hears those, I think, Grey, he hears noises outside and he goes out and touches the crypt. I was like, it's broad daylight. These things don't happen in broad daylight in a horror film. Wait till the sun sets.
Yeah, and then, you know, and then they go and they throw something completely different in there, you know, when they throw in the dog and, you know, because he rounds the corner and all of a sudden there's just this, like, angry dog standing there and it's like, it's like, where the hell did this thing come from?
Yeah. But that kind of, like, it almost felt like a throwback to, like, The Omen, or that kind of film, where there's always...
Yes.
I can't remember the nanny in The Omen's got these big two dogs, hasn't she? And it kind of, like, I think, plays on a couple of little things like that. But, I mean, what made me uncomfortable, and it always does in films nowadays, is the kind of whole baby sacrifice. I was just like, if I'd known this had been... And baby sacrifice had been an element, of this film beforehand, I probably would not have watched it, because that just makes me really uncomfortable now. I'm such a wimp mm-hmm. with things like that. And it wasn't just that, it was like the crying as well. And I was thinking, that's not a child crying, that's an actual tiny baby cry, and that made me really uncomfortable. Like, it just, the only way I can describe it, it's like it made my teeth itch. It was like this, I can't quite, my brain can't really process this information. And then I think, you know, they brought in, like, the elderly priest came in, Father, what's his name, Calvino, and they were like, oh, we're going to bless this church. But they kind of don't really know what's going on even then at this point. I mean, they find that book, and the book where he's saying, like, you know, I think I work for him now, and he is everywhere, and you need to get out of this town. You still don't kind of get a real sense of to what is actually going on, so like near enough, quite near the end, and then it all falls into place. And the ending, if anyone had guessed the ending of this film, I think I'd die of shock, because there is no way in hell I would have ever guessed the ending of this film.
Yeah, me either. You know, I mean, you know, from the point that, you know, they're looking down there, and, you know, they find that writing on the wall that's like, you know, forgive me and look after them, I serve a new master now, and I was like, yep, that totally tied to the book.
Yeah.
You know, that they found, and...
But I wasn't, and I'm sorry, if you haven't seen this film, you want to pause this podcast now and go watch it, because I'm about to talk about the ending. If you had told me that the church was going to eat them, I wouldn't have believed you. It was so... Like, but it wasn't like... You can almost, if you say to someone, oh yeah, and at the end, the church eats them, they probably laugh, but it's not... It's done in such a way that it's not, like, comical. And even though it's shocking, mm-hmm. they kind of handle it quite well. I mean, there's no big mouth or anything like that, or tentacles. There's just acid and enzymes and things like that. And it's so weird. But it's memorable as well. It's that kind of thing that you'll always remember is, oh, that film with the church eats those people at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just one of those things where you're like, hey, I did not expect that. You know, and it kind of reminded me of Cabin in the Woods or Drag Me to Hell or something, where all of a sudden it looks like everything's done, like they're about to, you know, get their answers or be able to walk away from this, and all of a sudden the demon, like the demon lord hand comes up and just grabs them down or something, and it's like, holy shit, where did you come from?
Yeah, it's so out of left field, but I can see why some people would absolutely hate the ending. But I really enjoyed it, because I was like, I have never seen it played like this before. I've never seen it played out like this before. You know, the church didn't collapse and there wasn't a big portal and that kind of thing. It was like, the church ate them. Like, yeah. And then, but then you kind of like, I think you, if you look back at it, you can almost see like this pagan deity. It wasn't just worshipped on this site. It was like physically there, and it's now... Like, it is the church. Like, and I don't know, that kind of made it, in some ways it sounds completely daft, but it's almost scarier, because, like, what can you do about, like, an actual living demon pagan church? Nothing. And the way, like, all the townspeople they talk to when they're going up to the church, they're all just, like, not interacting with them or anything. They're all complicit in what's going on, but what are they getting out of it? Is this deity protecting them? Have they got, like, you know, you will have bountiful crops and all that kind of thing? Like, I like the fact there was a little bit, no one came out and said, haha, we made a deal with this god 500 years ago and we sacrifice our firstborns with every fourth spring and we get this. It was just like, meh. You know, it was kind of just left, well, this is what it is and we don't know why.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and I mean, you know, there were strings of movies, you know, back in like the 80s, even early 90s, where, you know, you essentially have sort of the house that becomes alive.
Mm.
You know, and is trying to, like, the house itself is trying to kill you or something, you know, but I think that's what I liked and was able to appreciate with this movie, because it didn't feel like it's been done before. You know, I mean, yeah, at first, you know, when it's starting to move really slowly and everything, it's like, okay, you've got the whole shaky cam kind of experience, you know, and everybody investigating this, you know, haunted house and everything, but then you don't expect it to be this church, especially when you think, okay, the church of any house on Earth, or of any building on Earth, this should be, like, the most, like, divinely protected,
yeah,
you know, thing. Like, nothing should be able to take over this church.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot of films with, like, you know, like, vampires and things where people go, no, we have to get on sacred grounds, and they can't cross that line, and it's always the church they go to. And I think if you, like you were saying, you know, this is meant to be, like, a protected space, and it's not, there's this kind of ancient evil lurking there, then what does that say about, like, God? Is there no God? Is that the way these people worship it? Is God abandoned this site? Is it just so bad that there is no longer a Lord to protect it? And I thought it was interesting that, you know, this is a different religion, God, and the Catholic religion had no power over it. They tried to purify it, and it didn't work. Mm-hmm. And that was a really interesting element, because obviously you've got things like The Exorcist and the Omen series and even Rosemary's Baby, where, like, Catholicism is rooted in it because of the subject matter. But it was really interesting to see, not like that it was powerless in this sense, but that this was just, like, something really dark and primordial, and just something, like, totally adjacent to the religion everybody was, especially because, you know, the characters from the Vatican, and that's who they work for. And it was nice to see them come up against something that they necessarily didn't understand, because it wasn't something that, you know, it's obviously not something that anybody would expect, but, you know, because it was rooted in, like, Catholicism and the Vatican and that kind of thing, to see it be something different. It's not a demon, it's not the devil, it's this. I thought that was a really good, like, left field turn.
Oh yeah. And something that I thought was, you know, was interesting, and having, you know, even a background in kind of reading a little bit on things like this, you know, when you're looking at the tension between Deacon and Mark, you know, and Mark's just pretty much, you know, hey, I'm going to see to it that you never work at, you know, at this again, and, you know, things like that. It's like, you see that so much of the, well, I guess the Catholicism, you know, when you look at the structure and everything, it's almost not so much like the religious organization, like Body of Christ, so to speak, but, you know, just still more an organization of men, you know, yeah. And you look at it and it's like, okay, you know, or, you know, but, and because it is, you know, there's, you know, there's that old, you know, saying and passage and whatnot, that a house divided against itself will fall.
I think in some ways this is more interesting than the Babadook, but it's also a completely different, it's a bit batshit mental. That ending, it's not something I can wrap my head around quite yet, because I only really watched it this afternoon, but it's just so different. And I think it was really good that they did that, because it's, you know, it's a found footage film about a haunted church. You know, it's nothing that hasn't been done before, and that ending really helps elevate it past that.
Yeah, it definitely does. You know, it's kind of funny that we got to really watch and examine these two movies specifically together, because it really brings up, you know, modern horror and its examples of, you know, modern horror that's actually working.
Yeah, and I think if we move on to talk about modern horror, I mean, a lot of academics say that modern horror started in 1968 when the Hays Code was repealed and we had Rosemary's Baby and Night of the Living Dead. But if we talk about more recent horror, because every decade has kind of got its thing, it's, you know, what's mm-hmm. popular, what's not. And I think being in 2016, we can't quite see the trend right now, but we can see what's been popular and what's come out. And I think more so the, you know, the first 6 years of this decade, we've had, like, the Paranormal Activities films, and, you know, last decade we had, you know, was it 7 Saw films or 6 Saw films?
There were 7, and now they're talking about, like, either an 8th or they're planning to reboot it. I forget exactly which, but, you know, I heard that they do want to work on another Saw.
Yeah, and then we've had, like, there'll be, is it 3 Insidious films, 2 Conjuring films, mm-hmm. I'm probably missing out about 1,000 other films that they've made quick sequels of. And I think horror in the last 10, 15 years, probably a bit longer, has just been about rehashing. We've had so many remakes and reboots and prequels and sequels. I mean, I can't even keep up with the Texas Chainsaw Massacre timeline anymore, because I think I've seen a prequel, and then I saw another prequel, which wasn't anything to do with the first prequel, and then a couple of sequels, and then a remake. And then before that, we had, like, the whole the J-horror influx, where there was the remake of The Ring and The Grudge and Pulse and The Eye. And when something, did you make something like that, something that's new and popular, like Paranormal Activity, then they're so eager to keep repeating the success. And I think, I don't know, I wonder if when they make a horror film now, do they automatically have it in mind as a franchise? Like, that's something I often wonder, because, I mean, with these two films, you couldn't really make a sequel. Same with Cabin in the Woods. I remember there was an interview with the director, and he said, like, at a fan convention, someone said, are you going to make a film, a sequel? And he was like, did you see the ending? So even when you've got an ending like that, people are still asking. And I wonder if that's got a lot to do with that people don't want to see anything original, which is a wider problem in Hollywood at the minute. Or if the studios aren't just willing to put the money down for original things. Because like you said, The Babadook had, you know, what's it called?
Basically, no body count.
Things like that. I mean, I think executive seat horror film automatically means a couple of things. Mm-hmm. It means blood, guts, just violence, and maybe some pretty girl getting her boobs out. And these films had, like, neither of those things in, really. And like you said, Babadook, no one died. It's so strange to say, oh, it's a horror film, but no one dies in it. But, I mean, obviously, it's not, neither of these films are formulaic. We've just said, you could not have guessed the ending of The Borderlands in a million years. Anyone who says they did is a liar or a psychic, because mm-hmm. there is no way you could have thought of that. But, I mean, I don't know, what do you think about the state of modern horror in general?
For one, I think Hollywood is really afraid to take a chance. You know, that's why a lot of the movies like these two, you know, didn't have very, like, widespread worldwide releases. And, I mean, I can't think of a single theater where, you know, at least here in the States, where I would have been able to see The Babadook.
Mm.
You know, which I gladly would have liked to see on a big screen. You know?
Yeah, I mean, but when that came out, I mean, there's 1, 2, 3, 4... There's 5 cinemas in, like, the Liverpool area, and it was only the really big multiplex that was showing it, and it was only on one showing at 9 o'clock
of
a night, and that was it. Even, we've got an independent cinema in Liverpool, and they weren't showing it. It was just the big multiplex. So, and I remember when The Mist came out back in 2008, mm-hmm. me and my brother had to travel outside of Liverpool to watch it, because nowhere was showing it in Liverpool.
Oh, wow.
Which, and you think that's kind of shocking, considering the cinema in our city centre has got 14 screens, and that wasn't showing. It's a bit, and the thing is,
which is surprising. I loved The Mist, by the way.
I adore that film. That ending, though, depressed me for about a week and a half straight. I just couldn't stop thinking about it.
I even read the book recently, like the novella for it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, yeah, even Stephen King later went back and said, you know, this is the ending I should have written.
Yeah, I've read that. And apparently they're making a mini-series of it now.
Yeah.
So that'll be interesting. But see, that's another thing. They made the movie, and now they're making a mini-series out of it, which is, it's good in some sense, but it goes back to that nothing new kind of thing. And the thing is, I mean, I worked in the cinema for 5 years, and every time there was a horror film on, I could guarantee Friday, Saturday night, it would be absolutely packed with children who were too young to be legally going to see it.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be completely sold out, and it didn't matter if it was something like, you know, The Chernobyl Diaries, or if it was Saw 7 or whatever. It was always full, especially if we had them on like midnight screenings around Halloween. People loved horror films, and they would flock to see them. So during the research I've been doing for my thesis, I've only found one horror film that hasn't at least made its budget back, and that was Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3. Because they've usually got such small budgets that they will make the money back pretty easily. And, you know, if you remember back to The Evil Dead when that was made, they pretty much made that themselves, you know, of a weekend. Yeah. Just, and I know there was a film came out a couple of years ago. I think it was called Colin, and it's a zombie film. And I'm pretty sure they made that for £45.
Wow.
So, but at the same time, you know, how many other people are making horror films in their back garden that no one's paying attention to? But then you think, you know, we've got Kickstarter and all that now. Are we going to see a new wave of horror in the next couple of years? Really original stuff from people who don't necessarily need to go down the studio route to get the funding anymore, because other people will fund them. There's other avenues now. Is this going to open a whole new, you know, thing for us as horror fans?
I don't know, but I'm definitely hopeful, because, I mean, when you look at movies like, you know, The Babadook and, you know, like The Borderlands and, you know, just even thinking of another movie that I recently watched called The Visit, which was, I don't know if you've seen it, it was actually directed by M. Night Shyamalan, and it had to do with those two kids that went to spend the week at their grandparents' house.
Yeah.
Oh man, that movie was so much better than I expected it to be.
Yeah, I kind of had my expectations lowered because it was M. Night Shyamalan, but it was really...
Did really well with it, and it was one of his lowest budget films, actually, you know, if we want to start, you know, mentioning, like, the money side of it, you know, because it was made for just under $5 million, and...
Just nothing, is it really, these days?
Yeah, and... They said that opening weekend, at least in the, you know, at least in the States alone, it made over $25.4 million. So, I mean, it made its money back opening weekend.
I mean, when I think about, I was, you know, talking to my brother and asking, you know, what's been your favorite horror film like the last couple of years? And he couldn't name one. And I said, well, I really like Cabin in the Woods. And he was like, well, Cabin in the Woods isn't really horror. And I was just like, how is it not horror? But I also liked, I know I've just, like, slagged off remakes, but I really liked the Evil Dead remake because it felt very true to the spirit of the original without directly ripping it off.
Yeah.
You know, shot for shot. I really, really liked that. It can't, because when I watched Evil Dead, the first one, I'd already heard all this hype about how it was almost banned in the UK for being a video nasty, and I was like, oh, this is going to be really gory. But to me watching it in, like, the early 2000s, it wasn't. But I felt like the remake really embodied that spirit of, like, not slapstick, but that level of gore and kind of splatter, do you know? I really enjoyed it. And, I mean, don't get me wrong, if they start remaking, like, Jaws or Rosemary's Baby, I think I'll cry. Because some things, they just, you know, they should just be left alone. But then people can get it right. I just want to know what's going to happen next with horror. Are we going to keep having these... Are we stuck in a cycle now of remakes and sequels and prequels and 3D and D-box seats and all that kind of thing with the occasional little gem? Or are we going to finally have a move towards more originality? Because imagine if George Romero hadn't got the money back for Night of the Living Dead. You know, he produced that mostly on his own. He kind of raised the funds for that as much as he could back in 1968. And it revolutionized the zombie genre, so... Give people a chance. That's what I say. Let's just go out and get a camera with your friends and just make up something and then stick it on YouTube and you never know. Let's have a bit more originality. That's what I say.
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, we're already proving that, you know, that it's working. You know, and I think more and more people, when you see more independent films like this coming out or... You know, even on a different scale, like podcasts, you know, even people want to get into some type of broadcasting, you know, but, you know, don't want to just follow the same old standard radio formula and whatnot, you know, they can go out and they can go and put out their own original content, you know. So I think that, you know, I think it's going to take a few years for it to really materialize, but I think we are going to start seeing more original ideas, and I think there is going to be sort of a resurgence in original horror. Now, unfortunately, we're still going to have people out there that, you know, want to just remake what's already been done. You know, like we've had, you know, in the past decade or so, all of those remakes of the Japanese horror films, like One Missed Call or The Grudge or The Ring.
Yeah.
Stuff like that is still going to be there, but once you start grabbing more original ideas like The Babadook that, you know, break a number of the conventions, I mean, nobody got naked, nobody died. You know, it was, you know, and like you were saying, it didn't have all of this gore and everything, and so much of it was in our minds, you know, or something that, you know, people can go out, you know, completely out of left field, like we saw with, you know, the Borderlands, you know, with, you know, this living church, you know. It's like, I think that people are going to start catching on, and I think we are going to see it, but it's still going to be at least a few years down the road before we do.
Yeah, I agree. So maybe in a few years we'll come back and have the same conversation and see where we are then.
Oh, gladly.
That's all we've got time for tonight. I would like to thank Clint for coming on and being my guest. I had a really good time discussing horror tonight.
Yeah, this was a blast. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm glad we were able to, you know, to make it happen.
Yeah, if you want to tell people where they can find you online, Clint?
Oh, sure. Well, I'm the host of the Geek Dig podcast, and I'm also co-hosts of the Green Up Gaming Podcast and the Geek Up and Go Podcasts, all of which you can find on iTunes and Stitcher. For Geek Dig Pod, our website is www.geekdigpod.com. You can always email at geekdigpod@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter there at geekdigpod. Or for Green Up, if you want to get your game on, that's at greenuppodcast.com or greenuppodcast on Twitter. And for Geek Up and Go, you can pretty much right now hit us up at Geek Up and Go on Twitter. Geek Up and Go, the website's still under construction, but if you go there, you get to see a really pretty logo that I had nothing to do with designing.
You can follow us on Twitter at PickAFlickPod. We are available on iTunes, Acast, and Stitcher. We are also available on the website, blackholepodcast.com. You can follow me on Twitter, if you wish, at Crushinator2, but all I do is tweet about wrestling, so probably not. You can also follow me on Twitter at Dead Meat Horror. We haven't done an episode in a while, but hopefully episode 2 on Final Gale Theory will be edited by the end of the week, and look out for more Dead Meat in the future. So once again, I'd like to thank Clint for this evening, and it's been nice to be back on the podcast. And see you again soon. Bye.
Bye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This Mother's Day, treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their advanced eye care duo brightens and firms skin around your eyes, while the Golden Glow Body Trio nourishes and smooths skin all over. Go to OSEAMalibu.com and use code MOM for 10% off your first order site-wide.